Genesis chapter 49. Genesis chapter 49. Jacob called together, called his sons and said, "Gather together that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." Actually, who
raise your hand if you don't have chapter 49 questions. What time period is Jacob referencing when he says that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days?
I think we talked about that last week.
We're living in the last days.
All right. But is that the last days that he's talking of?
No, they're
okay.
In the future for them. Well,
it is simply latter days. That's the immediate translation. And the majority of the things he speaks of will happen to them during the Mosaical time period, which is not the last days as it's used later on in the Old Testament. Though, when you come down to the prophecies or the statements, blessings concerning Judah, verses 8 through the end, some of those will come all the way forward and look all the way forward to the Christ. But primarily the usage here, in contrast to much of the rest of the Old Testament, is simply what's coming in the future. This is what will happen in the latter days.
And if it has happened to you in days to come.
In days to come.
Statement.
Yes. And that is actually a very good translation. The term last days, because of the connotation, especially in the prophets, can often confuse people as to which time period this is talking about. This is just simply talking about in the days to come. Or in the years ahead is another way of in our terms, bringing that out. All right? Verse 2, "Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, you shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." So he begins with Reuben, the firstborn, and he's going to go through each of the sons throughout this chapter and give the blessing, though sometimes the blessing is not going to be a positive thing. In Reuben's case, it's not. He says, "You're strong. You are the son of my strength as the firstborn, but because of what you did," that is, he went in and he committed fornication with one of the handmaids of, I think it was the handmaid of Leah, and went into his father's wife. As a result of this, he says, "You will not, you're going to be as unstable as water. You're not going to excel. You're not going to have the place of prominence among your brethren that the firstborn would have." All right? Now, a point about water and unstability. Somebody suggests some ways how water is unstable, since that's the figure he uses.
How is it? It takes the easiest route.
Okay? Always takes the easiest route. It never goes uphill. It never goes against the current. Okay? So whichever way things are running, that's the way it's going to go.
It bends the mountains, it'll always take the form of whatever you pour it in.
Absolutely. It will always conform to that which is around it.
Yeah.
What else?
It's good to drink.
It's good to drink. I don't think that's really that qualifies that statement. Okay. It can be controlled by the forces around it, just exterior forces.
It evaporates.
So, the reality is you think about it, and as you think about it more, water is a very unstable substance in the sense, it's not such that you can just push down on it and it'll resist you in that sense.
It's not solid.
It's not solid. And that's what Reuben, as a tribe, is going to be. They are going to be those that are constantly fluctuating and those that are constantly struggling to have their own identity and have their own existence and have the place that they should have had, but Jacob says, "You're not going to have it. you're going to be as unstable as water. Verses 5 through 7, he moves on to Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty, instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Why the reference to cruelty here? All right. Go back to the earlier chapters when, I believe it's chapter 36. Or is it 38? 36 or 38, I don't remember which.
34.
Well, that would be correct. All right, chapter 34. 36 or 36, what? 36 is genealogies. Judah and Tamar 38. That was the problem. All right. Chapter 34, the incident with Dinah, their sister. They will be the ones that will go in and destroy the city of Shechem as a response to their sister having been raped. Catching up on the questions real quick. Number two, why was Reuben, I can't read tonight. Why was Reuben rejected as the firstborn? All right. Because of his fornication. All right. Verse 6, let not my soul enter their council, let not my honor be united in their assembly, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So what will be the consequence, or what would happen to Simeon and Levi as a result of their actions in Shechem?
They wouldn't have a tribe. They wouldn't, as a tribe, they would be scattered.
Okay. They would be scattered. Now, Levi would not have its own land inheritance. It would inherit cities, but as the priestly tribe, they wouldn't own an area of land. They wouldn't have their own section for their own tribe. So Levi was scattered in that sense. But when you start looking at the area that Simeon inherits, they will actually be swallowed up by Judah. As time goes on, because the area of Simeon's inheritance would be right in the vicinity of Judah, and eventually Judah would grow and basically encompass all of Simeon, and Simeon will eventually basically disappear into the tribe of Judah. And so they would be divided and they would be scattered throughout the tribe in that sense that Simeon will have its own inheritance for a time, but eventually that inheritance will be gone. And it will be that which is basically molded into the other tribes. So both of them, as a result of that which is stated, will be scattered, will be divided in Jacob, scattered in Israel. Verses 8 through verse 12 deals with Judah. Judah, you are he whom your brother shall praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion. And as a lion, who shall rouse him? Alright, so the first thing that Jacob emphasizes with Judah is he's going to be a powerful tribe. He is going to be the most powerful tribe. It's going to be interesting that by the time you get over into the days of the kings, it is the case that Judah's numbers of soldiers from their tribe alone will be almost equaling that of the rest of the 11, or the other 11 tribes put together. Because Judah would grow to be so powerful, they would have the largest land inheritance. By the time that the land expanded all the way to the greatest borders it had during Solomon's day, they would be the tribe with the single most power physically among all the nations. But you're also going to see, as we bring out in the next verse, that they're also going to have the kings that will come from their tribe. And so a number of these things will be parts of that we'll see in reality coming about from what Jacob says. Verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet. What is a scepter? It is a rod, and it specifically is the rod that the king possessed. It was the symbol of the king's authority. So, in order for the scepter to not depart from Judah, that is a direct statement of kingship. The kingship in Israel would not depart from Judah. Notice also the second part. Nor a lawgiver from between his feet. Lawgiver. What's that a connotation of? Verse 10. Second statement in verse 10. No, not the priest.
Is it referring to Christ?
Ultimately, it will be in full culmination, but it's referring to a king again.
Yeah.
Both the scepter and the lawgiver were attributes of the king. They were the only individuals who, by their own authority in a monarch nation, could give law and possess that authority of the king. The priests didn't make the laws. They didn't give the laws. They were the ones who were to be the ones who made sure that the people knew God's laws. Okay? This is the idea of a law maker, a law giver. He establishes those laws. And so these two statements are a direct prophecy that the kingship in Israel would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. Now, there's a great deal of discussion and debate, depending upon many your people's theological perspective, as to who this Shiloh is. The term is simply a reference to peace in the Hebrew. I have the direct translation of it written down, and I forgot to bring what it was written down on. But it comes with this idea of peace, but it's a specific reference that's going to go forward based upon other biblical history. It's going to go forward straight to Christ. And this is a prophecy of the Messiah. And so the statement is going to be concerning Judah, that the lawgiver, the king, the one with the scepter, would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. Now, when you go forward into the Old Testament, into the latter portions, 2 Chronicles, for instance, you're going to find that the kingship in Israel ends. It ends when they go into Babylonian captivity. But when you step over to the prophets, God's going to tell Zerubbabel, you're going to be my signet. You're going to stand in the place as governor, but the kingship would not exist in the full sense. It would not exist from the time that they went into Babylonian captivity until Christ came. But here's the other point. Simultaneously, there was never another king that reigned over Israel as a nation that was an Israelite. From one of the tribes, there was never another one that came that was not from Judah. And so the prophecy is completely fulfilled in Christ. It's not negated by the fact that there was a time where they didn't have any kings, because that line of Judah's kingship goes straight to the Messiah. Eddie?
What were you asking, or you said you had something about that word.
What's the literal definition of Shiloh? I had it written down, but I
The word is Shiloh, that means tranquil, and it's an epithet of the Messiah.
Okay, so it's just that idea of tranquil or peace that it carries with it that idea. Notice, and to him.
Did that go in the song with Judah or not? What did they say? A long day.
Mm-hmm. Is that chapter 40?
Chapter 60.
Oh, chapter 60.
Verse 10.
Psalm 60 and verse 7. All right.
The other name, I can't remember.
Right. Let me look at that real quick. Psalm 60. Yes. Yes, that would be correct. Because verse 7 says, Gilead is mine, Manasseh is mine, Ephraim also is the helmet of my head, Judah is my lawgiver. Okay? So the tribe of Judah is going to hold that place historically throughout the existence of Israel through David's line. And notice the end of the verse says, and to him. Alright? Now, here's something important. Shiloh can't be a location. It can't be a movement. It can only be a him. Because that's what the remainder of the verse says. It attributes to this term, Shiloh, which isn't a person's name. It attributes to it a personhood. So we know it's referencing someone. Until Shiloh come, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples.
Let me read it from this one. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him.
Okay.
What does that mean?
Until tribute?
Until tribute comes to him, and to him shall be the obedience of the people.
I have to dig into that one. Because I didn't run into that.
And in my Bible, where it has a star by all references of Christ, it has that star that it is a reference to Christ.
Okay. Now, one point, there in the end, when you read, and to him shall be the obedience of the people, in the Hebrew, term people there is plural. It's peoples. It's not people. It's not the idea of one single people, but a multiplicity of them. So you could say, well, that may be the idea of a king over all the tribes. But when you look at it, it fits perfectly with Christ, king over Jew and Gentile. All right? So that's something that certainly you could do some more studying on, and would it would benefit you and be beneficial to your faith. So question number 4, what two things would not depart from Judah until Shiloh comes?
Scepter and lawgiver.
And explain what these two things are.
Kingship.
All right, they're referencing the kingship, and the scepter specifically is a rod. That's a rod of king's authority. Okay? Verse 11, continuing with Judah, binding his donkey to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, his teeth whiter than milk. And so this is just simply the idea of bringing out visually the perception of the bloodiness of the tribe of Judah as a result of their battles, their wars, and so on. But also simultaneously, it carries with it some of the picture of how prosperous they would be and how they would be prospered in their land. Verse 13 concerning Zebulun. Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon. While Zebulun will not be on the coast immediately, it would benefit from the traffic of the ships and the ship-bound freight and transportation that would have existed on the Sea of Mesopotamia. Notice also, verse 14, Issachar. Mediterranean, sorry. Mesopotamia. The Mediterranean Sea. Verse 14. Issachar is a strong donkey lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good and that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. You go on again through the Old Testament history, and Issachar will be one of those tribes that's going to constantly be under the burden of someone else. They're going to be those who would be subservient and be in a position of being slaves. as a result of their own actions. Verse 16, beginning with Dan. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path, that bites the horse's heels, so that its rider shall fall backward. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord. Now, verse 18 may or may not be directly connected to Dan, but simply be an interjection of Jacob stating, in these things that are going to happen, that are not going to be good things, his trust and reliance that he hopes they're going to have, as he has had their trust and reliance on God, and waiting for his, that is God's, salvation. But Dan is going to be described as a serpent, by the way. He's going to be troublesome, not only for those in Israel at times, but also for those outside, those who would come in and seek to do harm to Israel. He was going to be the one that would cause problems and cause interference to be run when those nations from the outside came in and tried to invade Israel. So there's kind of that dual idea there with the tribe of Dan. What tribe was compared to a snake? Dan. All right. Verse 19. Gad, a troop, shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last. Bread from Asher shall be rich, he shall yield royal dainty. So here with this, both Gad and Asher, very brief statement of Gad being able to triumph eventually in their own as a tribe, and then Asher having that rich and bountiful area of land that they would possess. Naphtali, verse 21, is a deer let loose. He uses beautiful words. Now, there's a couple of different ideas on the translation of that phrase, that last part. So if you check, for instance, King James versus ASV, ESV, and some of the others, you're going to get some different ideas there. I don't know that there's really a great deal that you can point to in the remainder of the Old Testament that looks at a fulfillment of that particular statement concerning Naphtali. Verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough. A fruitful bough by a well, his branches run over the wall. The archers had bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him, but his bow remained in strength. And the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. By the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb, the blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. So here in this section is a statement concerning Joseph. Now, Joseph isn't going to have a tribe. There's no tribe of Joseph. What two tribes are going to be referenced by this? All right. Ephraim and Manasseh. I'm trying to remember the answer to verse 6 or to number 6. All right.
What did she say?
The answer is he will be a fruitful tree.
Doesn't it mean that he's going to do well, that he is going to prosper? I mean, because it mentions the idea of a fruitful bough by a well, but the branches run over the wall. When you think about a bush, it just runs over. It's got plenty to sustain it, and it does well and bears lots of fruit,
mm-hmm.
provides for many.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the answer to.
He had a lot of strength. The arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God.
Yeah. I'll verify that was that I wrote the question right. I'll verify that by next week. Because
he was abundantly blessed too, wasn't he?
Yes. And that part is clear. That Joseph's going to receive the blessing. He's going to be bountiful. Ephraim is going to be the greatest tribe in the northern kingdom. Ephraim and Judah will be the two most powerful tribes in Israel. And so that idea, God being with him, God blessing him, and you're going to see that even as we continue on and finish up the book of Genesis. All right.
You said Ephraim would be in the northern kingdom. Is that because of just where they were located? Because when you look at the land, Manasseh had much more land in the northern kingdom than Ephraim did.
Manasseh will have a greater land, but Ephraim will be the more powerful of the two.
Is it because of being located closer to Jerusalem?
It's going to be part of that, but also the capital of the northern kingdom, Samaria, is going to be in Ephraim's land. And so many of the kings will be part of Samaria and Ephraim by that time period. That's where it's going to be located. And so you're going to have Ephraim as the most significant of the northern kingdoms. For instance, when you go to the book of Hosea, throughout the prophecy of Hosea, Hosea is going to reference Israel and Ephraim. And what he means by that as he goes through the book is Ephraim's the reference to the leaders of the northern kingdom of Israel, and Israel is reference to the people, the nation of the northern kingdom. And so Ephraim is going to be that powerhouse, as it were, in the northern kingdom of Israel and the tribes there.
What was the description you gave of them before we started all the other conversation about? Were they the top two in the kingdom?
They will be, yes, Judah and Ephraim will be the two most powerful tribes in of Israel. I was going to look. No, I was going to verify something. Mm-hmm. All right. The end of the chapter then. Verse 27, let's get Benjamin first. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey. At night he shall divide the spoil. So Benjamin is going to also be a very significant tribe. Of course, what king came from Benjamin?
Saul.
Saul will. And there will actually be a great deal of the wars, especially with the Philistines, that will be fought in the vicinity of Benjamin's territory because of the proximity to the Philistines. And they're also going to be part of that defense from the southern routes. All right, verse 28. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them, and he blessed them. He blessed each one according to his own blessing. Then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. When Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Where did Jacob command that he was to be buried, and who else was buried there?
In the cave at Machpelah.
Okay.
And Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, and Rebekah, and Leah.
Okay. So he will be buried with Leah, his wife, not Rachel. Now, why is it, do you think, that Leah was buried there and Rachel wasn't?
Rachel was not in that area when Rachel died.
Okay. The answer is pretty much as simple as that. Rachel died on their way to Bethlehem, not in the vicinity of the cave of Machpelah. And so she was buried where she died. Leah, by all indications, would have died after Jacob had settled there in that vicinity, in that land, near where Isaac was.
That's interesting that Leah was not his favorite wife, and yet he gets to spend his
Yes. life. Yes, indeed.
But he did say that he was going to the cave of his father, buried me with my father, so he
That's
was
right.
not as worried at all about Leah as much as it was Abraham and Isaac.
All right. I'm sure he didn't notice at all. Just out of curiosity, how many days did it take to embalm Jacob?
40.
How many days were the Egyptians going to mourn Jacob's death?
70.
All right. You are dismissed. Oh, you don't think I can take 10 or so weeks on chapter 50? I can try. Go ahead and start reading the book of Daniel, because that's what we'll be studying when we're through.